Stay with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sulis. Interested in learning new skills online at a pace that suits you? Visit ecollege.ie to apply for one of our free online courses.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Now, this month, 100 years ago, a hunger strike by Cork Republican Mary McSweeney captured national and international headlines. It caused considerable embarrassment to the provisional government attempting to implement the Anglo-Irish Treaty and deal with the challenge of civil war. It also underlined the depth of the anti-treaty belief in their cause, the role of women in highlighting that cause, and brought her, Mary McSweeney, into conflict with the Catholic Church. So who was she and why did her hunger strike cause such a stir in November of 1922? Well, Dermot Ferriter, Professor of Modern Irish History in UCD, is back with us to tell us this story. Good morning, Dermot.
Good morning, Claire.
Fascinating backstory to Mary McSweeney. She started her life in England.
She was the eldest of seven surviving children in London of a Cork father and an English mother. We don't know an awful lot about her mother, but her father was really an unsuccessful businessman. And they moved back to Cork when she was seven. And he tried to start a snuff and tobacco business, which didn't work out well. It's actually quite sad. He ended up emigrating to Australia alone in 1895. But he had an intense belief in the cause for freedom. You know, he was very strongly separatist in his views. And that was the kind of household that Mary grew up in. She was the eldest. And of course, there was the younger brother Terence, who people would be very familiar with, Terence McSweeney, but also her sister Annie, who was a formidable woman in her own right. What's interesting about that household is that they're very immersed in cultural nationalism as well, so the Gaelic League and dramatic societies. But she actually comes to prominence as a suffragette, which is often forgotten because of her association with the Republican cause. She was a member of the Munster Women's Franchise League, which had been established in the early 20th century. And she really believed strongly in the right of women to vote as a matter of justice. So that's how she comes to prominence first. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's the increasing political temperature that takes her on a new path and diverts her energies really into the cause of Irish republicanism.
I'm fascinated by the fact that her father left when she was only 13. He was never to return, was
no,
he?
He wasn't.
And yet the profound impact that he clearly had on her.
Yeah. And the mother, interesting, and the mother dies in 1904, 1905. And Mary's then head of household.
Yes,
so she has that role as well. Mm. And she's a very committed educationalist. And her own education was interrupted so much by bad health that she didn't really finish her education until about the age of 20. And she was actually teaching in St. Angela's Ursuline Convent School, where she had been taught herself. So she's a very committed teacher and a very progressive educationalist, as was her sister Annie. And what happens in the aftermath of the 1916 Rising is that because she's now associated with Cumann na mBan, and the cause of 1916, and of course her brother Terence has been imprisoned after it, and she makes representations on his behalf. She's becoming increasingly politicised, but she's actually arrested in the classroom when she's teaching by the Royal Irish Constabulary, and she's dismissed from her job. And eventually herself and Annie established their own school, St. Edith's, in Cork, which again was associated very much with a progressive attitude to education, a bit like Patrick Pearson, St. Enda's. So she has all of that. All of that experience and that side to her career before she's really thrust into a very prominent and public spotlight.
And what led to that happening? Was that what happened to her brother?
Very much, yeah. The arrest of Terence McSweeney, who of course is an elected Sinn Féin politician. He's Lord Mayor of Cork, and he famously endures a 74-day hunger strike, one of the pivotal events of the War of Independence. He dies in October 1920. But the crucial point about Mary here is that she becomes very much the spokesperson, along with her sister Annie and also Muriel, the wife of Terence McSweeney. She's dealing with the press. She's keeping vigil outside of the prison and indeed beside his bed. And she watches that horrible hunger strike unfold over the course of such an extended period. And the way it was described by Annie in her diary at the time, that their brother went into prison as a 5'9½, 136-pound man. He left in a coffin looking like an emaciated 12-year-old child. And you can only imagine the trauma that was generated as a result of that, and all the representations that she had to make to the authorities, to the medical authorities, the prison authorities, the political authorities. She's briefing the press daily. This is a big international story as well. So Mary assumes a public profile there that really brings her certain skills. There's no doubt about that. She was absolutely formidable, and she was a very impressive speaker. And she's also sent to America then with Muriel, the widow of Terence McSweeney, to Washington to give evidence to the American Commission that's looking into the situation in Ireland during the War of Independence. So they go to Washington. And then later in 1921, she embarks on a seven-month tour of the United States, 58 cities, some 300 meetings. And she really does become the spokesperson for the Republican cause.
This all happened very quickly after Terence's death. He died in 1920, and she's doing this tour of America the year after.
And then she's elected a TD herself for Cork City. So she becomes one of the leading Sinn Féin female politicians during that period.
So understandably, she had huge profile in the aftermath of that.
She did. And it's interesting, Leanne Lane, who's working on a biography of Mary McSweeney, has made the point that her mind also narrowed around that particular trauma and the death of her brother. And she wants to keep that flame alive, but she also wants it to be presented as a good death, as a meaningful death, as a death that can be invoked in order to further the cause. But she can also do that in her own right as a politician and as a very effective spokesperson nationally and internationally for that cause. But it's the events in the Dáil at the end of 1921 that forge her reputation as the ultimate diehard and militant, as she was seen. Her speech against the treaty is absolutely extraordinary. On the 21st of December 1921, she got up in the afternoon and she spoke for 2 hours and 40 minutes, longer than anyone else. The transcript, handwritten transcript of her speech, is held in the National Archives. It's 160 pages, some 15,000 words, and she made no apologies for the duration of the speech and the length of it. She was mocked and derided by some, but there's also an appreciation that she has a particular message to communicate at that time. She doesn't mention Terence directly, but she invokes his example. She invokes what they had experienced around it. So she is speaking, yes, on her own behalf, but she is also channeling the ghost, really, of Terence McSweeney. So it's that combination. And again, it led to a reaction that on the part of some was about mocking her.
Well, it's hard to make a quality speech of that duration, 2 hours and 40 minutes. Was it a quality speech?
Well, I mean, she was prone to melodramatic speeches. There's no doubt about that. But she was an effective orator. She talks about there being no possibility of compromise for those who hold the Republic as a living faith. She says that you can exterminate the men and the women will replace them. You can exterminate the women and the children will replace them. You can wipe out the children and the blades of grass dyed with their blood will rise like dragon's teeth and arm the men of the next generation. It's that kind of tone. It's not for the faint-hearted. And she also, of course, criticises those who suggest that if the treaty's good enough for Mick Collins, it's good enough for me. She says, would you go to hell if Michael Collins went to hell in the morning? Would you go with him? And she is very critical of David Lloyd George and the disingenuousness of the British government. So it's a combination of all of those different elements, but constantly coming back to this idea of the Republic as a living faith. And when you see her correspondence with Eamon de Valera during this period, you can see an exasperated fondness on the part of Eamon de Valera. He says to her, you're incorrigible. He said, I'm trying to be angry with you, but I can't, because you're incorrigible. And because he, you know, he respects the depth of her conviction and there is a warmth between them. But de Valera says to her, I cannot stay on that plane of faith and unreason that you are on. You know, you're at your own level. You're at a different level. And ultimately, that relationship was to become frayed and very difficult.
Because of his willingness to compromise.
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, this is the word that Mary McSweeney hates, compromise. You know, she maintains that insistence to the end that there can be no compromise. And it's a very stark message. Mm-hmm. And it's a very difficult message. But she also follows it up with actions.
So when exactly did that relationship fracture?
It's getting very difficult by the end of 1920, but it really fractures completely when de Valera decides that he doesn't have a future with anti-treaty Sinn Féin, when he loses the argument about the idea of Sinn Féin taking their seats in the Dáil to try and dismantle the treaty. She's having absolutely none of that. But that comes after the Civil War.
So then let's talk about her hunger strike, which was this month, 100 years ago, November of 1922.
She was arrested in Ballsbridge on the 4th of November and taken to Kilmainham and immediately she embarked on a hunger strike. I think we have to remind ourselves sometimes just what damage hunger striking did. Because we, you know, when we talk about Terence McSweeney's 74 days, which is, you know, exceptional, and nobody really was aware just how long people could last on hunger strike. But Mary McSweeney was on hunger strike for 24 days. A hunger strike of that duration does enormous damage physically and mentally and emotionally, but she was absolutely determined. She refused to see doctors and she was adamant that she was going to see this through to the end. And it creates a huge dilemma for the government of the time.
And she wasn't, as you said, she wasn't a woman of robust health. She an amputee?
She was an amputee, yes. She had had a foot amputated as a result of those childhood difficulties, those health difficulties. So, you know, she's not robust in that sense, but she has extraordinary determination and resilience. And her sister Annie is also fasting outside the gates of the jail in sympathy with her and trying to bring greater attention to the cause. And she's taken off to a nursing home, Annie, after a week of fasting. Mary's getting progressively weaker and the pressures are mounting because there are resolutions coming in from local authorities in Ireland. There are representations being made from America. You cannot allow this woman to die. There will be blood on the hands of the provisional government, but also because of what had happened to her brother, that this would become a huge storm internationally.
So what happened?
What happened was that the government refused the entreaties that were being made. They held the firm line, but then they came to a realisation, no, we cannot let her die. They released her to a nursing home on grounds of failing health after 3 and a bit weeks of hunger strike. And that saved them some face and it saved the life, of course, of Mary McSweeney. But she's back in prison in April 1923 and she embarks on another hunger strike, a 19-day hunger strike. But there's also the Catholic Church dimension. We know that the Catholic Archbishop of Dublin, Dr. Byrne, was writing privately to W.T. Cosgrave as head of government saying, you cannot allow this woman to die. But Mary McSweeney and the Catholic Archbishop have their own row about her being refused communion. And she is outraged as a very devout practicing Catholic that she is not in a state of sin. But he's making the point that you're breaking divine law by embarking and remaining on this hunger strike. You cannot be absolved and you cannot receive Holy Communion. And there's an exchange of letters between them also in the National Archives, which reveals, you know, the depth of that row and the length of the correspondence. And she accuses the Catholic Church of taking political sides, which we discussed recently.
Yes,
and
yes,
they were taking political sides. But she's making the point that you're supporting those she calls perjurers and materialists and job hunters. And you're driving away people like me who represent truth and faith.
And how did she use her release on both occasions as a political tool?
She remains at the forefront of the Republican opposition, of the female Republican opposition in particular. Her hunger strike has to be put in the broader context of the incarceration of women. Nearly 600 women, anti-treaty Republicans, incarcerated during the Civil War. A huge number. And about 90 of them went on hunger strike. And that had implications for them long term, even if they were only on it for, you know, a relatively short time. So, you know, she's very much to the public fore. She is the face of the uncompromising Republican. Mm-hmm. And that is part of the propaganda battle throughout this period. It also leads to a ferocious reaction. P.S. O'Hegarty famously described these women as the Furies, but he also charged them with being responsible for the bitterness and ferociousness of the Civil War. It's laid squarely at their feet. W.T. Cosgrave also told Archbishop Byrne that it was largely the women who were regarded who were responsible for the destructive spirit during that period.
I wonder how much of what she had to say in the Dáil that day, which we were speaking about earlier, was that the breeding ground for that sentiment?
In some respects it was, but it was also about articulating what had been building. You know, Cumann na mBan had trenchantly rejected the treaty well before this. You know, there's a very strong groundswell of opinion against the treaty amongst those women. And she was one of 6 women TDs, all of whom voted against the treaty. Mm-hmm. So there's quite a backstory there. You know,
yes,
it has been building up. But she is the most effective orator of them. And she does carry that extra recognition and profile, both because of her own traits, but also because of the example of her brother and that sense that she's carrying that.
So what then, Dermot, became of her after the Civil War?
She couldn't keep unity within the Republican movement, particularly after the creation of Fianna Fáil. She never forgives Éamon de Valera for establishing Fianna Fáil. She's glad to see the change of government in 1932 because, as she sees it, the murder gang is being replaced by something more acceptable. But she is still not prepared to make the compromises that Fianna Fáil had made to get to power in 1932. She remains loyal to the Second Dáil of 1922, and they eventually agree that the IRA will take authority there. But she also leaves Cumann na mBan in the 1930s because she feels they're going too far in a left-wing direction. And eventually she resigns from Sinn Féin because Father Michael O'Flanagan, who's the president of Sinn Féin, is also working as a civil servant, and she doesn't recognise the legitimacy of the state. And she dies in 1942 at the age of 69. And De Valera informally approached the family, her sister Annie, suggesting that he would attend the funeral, and he was contemptuously dismissed. They did not want Eamon De Valera at Mary McSweeney's funeral. So her message remained consistent and stark to the end. No compromise.
Yeah, no compromise, no dilution of her views. Once she saw how the dust was settling after the Civil War, she was not for budging from her
position.
No,
and it's a reminder of the difficulty of keeping unity within the Republican movement at that stage, because it's so fractured. An awful lot of the anti-treaty Republicans accepted that there was a future in this new political crusade of Eamon De Valera. There was a future in Fianna Fáil. And those who reject that, of course, become increasingly marginalised, particularly in the support for the IRA, because ultimately the poachers become the gamekeepers in power. The IRA is declared an illegal organisation in 1936. By the time of the outbreak of the Second World War, they're regarded as a threat nationally to the security of the state. And De Valera and his government are actually prepared to see IRA men die on hunger strike or even execute them due to subversion. So relations really become poisoned. And you can, of course, trace them back to exactly 100 years ago and the depth of the divisions that were there. And that sense that the battle that was being fought in 1922 wasn't just about 1922. Mm-hmm. It was about those who had died beforehand. And it was about those who were going to keep the Republican flame lit.
We could keep going for the next hour, but Ronan Collins wouldn't be too happy with me. Dermot, thank you very much for joining us. And Dermot will be back with us in a couple of weeks. That's all we have time for today. Thank you very much for listening. Ruth Kennington was on sound today. The programme was produced by Deirdre Neiline. Our broadcast coordinator is Louise Kerr. And now we go over to Ronan Collins.